The Financial Times guides you through complex issues. In divisive times, don't settle for black and white. When you need the full perspective, turn to FT.com. Become a subscriber today. Search for FT subscription.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast, episode 1037. It's the 9th of April 2018. On the podcast today, I have Merlin Mar Johnson, Chief Executive Officer of Eris Resources. That's ERIS, and Merlin discusses their new gold project, Nordgruvan, in Sweden. Plus, I also have, as of Monday, Malki, Oil and Gas Sector Authority, talking about the following companies: Faro Petroleum, that's FPM, Ithaca Energy, IAE, Amerisa Resources, AMER, Savannah Petroleum, SAVP, Echo Energy, that's Echo, Chariot Oil and Gas, CHAR, and Providence Resources, PVR. Plus, at the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs too.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Merlin Mar Johnson, CEO of Eris Resources. That's ERIS, ticker. And Merlin, thanks for coming back on.
Good morning.
Now, you've got some exciting news out, and we'll get to that in a bit. Before we do, for people new to the podcast and you haven't been listed long, so I'm sure there's plenty of people out there that's not heard of Eris Resources. So explain, what is Eris Resources all about, please, Merlin?
Eris Resources is a European-focused mineral exploration company with a portfolio of zinc prospects in Ireland and gold projects in Sweden. We've got partnerships with two mid-tier Canadian companies, Osisko Gold Royalties and Centerra Gold. Osisko Gold Royalties are a cornerstone investor. They own 19% of the company, excuse me. And Centerra Gold are funding the Swedish gold project in an area of interest in the Skellefteå mining district. So they are funding all the gold projects in Sweden.
Yeah, it's always very interesting when I see a smaller company, and you've got a you've got two bigger companies, not only one. But it's always an area of interest for me, and to me, it's a flag that says, "Have a look at this." So, it's worth it. How did you? I mean, obviously, I probably can't tell the detail, but how did you guys hook up them with these bigger companies?
Oh well, having these two companies, as you say, is a huge endorsement of the team and our strategy. Eris Resources is a small company, but we've got lots of very experienced geologists in the team and proven mine finders. And these mine finders in Eris Resources are followed by industry, and we've got long working relationships with key players in industry. And so that goes back to the founders of Osisko Gold Royalties and several of the people in Centerra Gold. And in fact, Centerra Gold is just about to start commissioning a new gold mine, or building a new gold mine in Turkey, that was discovered by the founding directors of Eris Resources. So the relationships go back a long way.
Okay, well, news out is that you've got a new gold project in Sweden. I'm not going to pronounce where it is, because I may get it wrong, but I'll leave that to you. So take us through the detail, please, if you could, Merlin.
Yes, we've got a new gold project. It's called Nordgruvan. We applied for two licenses direct from the Swedish government, and they are actually in southern Sweden in the Bergslagen district. And they were freely available, and we've gone back through all the data sets in Sweden. We've reinterrogated the data, looked for where the gold occurrences are, reviewed the geophysics, and picked out a series of targets which we think were the most prospective, and we've applied for two of these, and they've just been granted. It's in a area of historic mineralization, and there are reported grades of up to 68 grams a ton at surface on one of the licenses.
Wow.
So we're just delighted that we were able to generate this new project, which should create value for the Eris shareholder. And this was done from first principles within the company at an extremely low cost.
Yeah, and I'm just looking back. I mean, you were your first day of dealings was in December 21st, which was last year. You raised like 4 million at 25 pence. You're now at just a sub-5 million market cap. Now, it's been a tough time for the markets, but you've got a lot going on there for a sub-5 million market cap when you seem to have quite a bit of cash as well.
Absolutely, we've got over £3 million in cash. We raised four gross, and we've got exploration going on in Ireland at the moment, which we are funding, and we've got exploration ongoing in Sweden, which is being funded by Centerra Gold. This new project is not part of that joint venture with Centerra. It's wholly owned. And about 6 weeks ago, or 2 months ago, we did a similar thing in Ireland. We picked up a new suite of projects at a very low cost, simply reinterrogating the data and applying direct to the government for the licenses. So we've got these two mature exploration projects with the drilling in Ireland and the drilling in Sweden. And meanwhile, in the background, bubbling along, Eris geologists are picking up these new projects, this Nordgruven one here in Sweden. We did the Galway project in Ireland, just adding to the portfolio, potentially adding value for shareholders.
Yeah. And so of all these projects there, so what is the most advanced at the moment?
The flagship project really is the Abytown project in the northwest of Ireland. It's based on an old mine, yeah. And the old mine actually is in a current and active quarry. So we will be gaining access to the underground workings. We're looking at a brownfield potential development of that old mine. We're also doing regional exploration around that old mine. So that's perhaps the most advanced project that we've got, that we own on a 100% basis. In Sweden, Centerra Gold has elected to earn into three separate projects, and one of those has got 20 holes in already, and we've got a good idea that we can target a resource on that project. That's called the Brandberg project. So we've got two kind of more advanced projects.
Yeah, absolutely. Excellent stuff. And just a quick thoughts on, the macro side of things as far as zinc and gold. What's your thoughts on those?
Goodness. Both commodities have not had a large amount of new discoveries in recent years. So the supply side is constrained. Yes, the much higher zinc prices are now stimulating some more material to come back into the market. But if you actually look at on the larger scale, we haven't had the big gold or the big zinc discoveries. So the longer term supply side is still constrained. Demand for both commodities is steady or growing. So we're relatively comfortable that we're going to see sustained, consistent prices. They're both well supported commodities to be in.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Merlin, if anyone's listening right now and likes the sound of what you're doing, how much you've got going on there, and in what sector you're in, but are not following the story yet, give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page and add you to their watch list, please.
The first reason is quality. We've got a quality team backed by industry in sensible commodities in excellent jurisdictions, and we've got really good projects. Mm-hmm. The second reason is value. We're essentially two companies in one. We've got the Irish portfolio backed by the Swedish portfolio, which is funded by Centerra, and the whole entity is trading at just above cash value. So we're deeply discounted no matter which way you look at us. And then the third reason is catalysts. We've got over 10,000 meters of drilling going in over the next 6 months. We've got plenty of news flow coming up. We're looking to drive value through making discoveries.
Absolutely. And I know many people who've listened to this podcast have heard Jeremy Martin on the podcast talking about Horizonte. And he's, of course, non-exec chairman there. So people will know him anyway. But you see, people can check out the rest of the board by going to the website there. Merlin, thanks very much for that. And like I said, you've got a lot going on. So hopefully we'll be chatting again in the not too distant future. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Oil and Gas Sector Authority. It's Malky. You all right, fella?
Very well indeed, thanks, Justin, and you?
Yeah, not too bad. I don't know what it's like where you are, but it's a horrible, dark, grey, wet morning, Monday morning. Dreadful, really. You know, it's not spring-like at all.
It couldn't be worse. It's, as you say, absolutely grey, lashing with rain. Horrible. I'm glad I'm in my office here and ready to go for you on the on my oil and gas stocks, which have been waiting in some cases for a couple of weeks while we haven't spoken.
Yeah, exactly. A bit of setup box and all that stuff. So, marvel. What's the first company you're looking at, Marky?
Well, we've got to talk about Faro, first of all, because not only is it important for Faro itself, but it's important for the rest of the sector. And I talk about that in two respects, because last week we had, first of all, the announcement of their successful discoveries, but more importantly, in a way, the fact that DNO had been sort of picking up stock. So I'll go through that, and I think that in a way it's a bit of a shame, but because Faro is one of the, if not the best, over the long term period of discoverers of oil in the North Sea, the Norwegian Sea, and so on. Indeed, ironically of all, on the day that DNO made their announcement, Faro announced that they'd made a double discovery on Hades and Iris, which there are two discoveries. They're completely separate discoveries, but they're one above each other, as it happens. And they're both quite substantial. They're both very close to local infrastructure. They can go to the Marvin Field or the Asgard complex, so that would be quick and easy and cheap, and bring on that very, very quickly. I think that their expression was significant commercial resources, which I would certainly agree with. And they've got other wells drilling at the moment. They've got an appraisal well also near Asgard. So, you know, in terms of, you know, operationally, Faro continue to deliver the goods, you know, year in, year out. Yeah, and this discovery, or these discoveries, were in acreage which had been in the portfolio for a while. So that they, you know, they're very clever. They have a good portfolio of stuff. They drill it when it seems appropriate. They're very tax efficient, and as I say, that it's infrastructure sensible. So, you know, very much one of the best. You know, and when I went to write out the bucket list, Faro was pretty much right at the top there for all those reasons. Mm-hmm. And then DNO announced last week that they had bought the 15.37% stake, which had been held by Delek. You'll remember them from Ithaca. I'll come back to Ithaca in a minute. And then they did they bought in the market through buy-in that they did, and they bought another 10%. And then clearly there was a bit of sellers over when it came to that, and so they bought another 2.32%. So they now own, I wouldn't be surprised if it wasn't a bit more by now, but they last declared number, I think it was 27.68%. And they have said that they don't plan to take the company over, at least at the moment, and they're going to be supportive shareholders for the management. You know, well, with friends like this, you don't need enemies. But the point is that, interestingly enough, Faro have fought off a number of suitors in the past, and Graham Stewart and his team certainly believe that this at 125p, this significantly undervalues the company, which I agree with. My guess is that you know, what we'd have here is that you know, the shame in the sense that the short-termism of some of the shareholders have sold out quite a lot of the stock. But if they were to make a bid and they wanted to have it agreed by the management, the rest of the company would cost a lot more than the equivalent of 125p a share, let me tell you that. But it is, the point about the whole industry, Justin, is what I've been saying. And I wrote in the blog at the time that I did the bucket list, I said that you know, that the sector contains a whole bunch of companies which are massively undervalued. The market just hasn't worked out that we've got $70 oil, And we've got costs coming down over the years very substantially. I mean, one of the leading UK companies I spoke to last week said that they've got over 70% reduction in costs now. So, you know, if you've got costs at that sort of level, at $60 to $70, these guys are making out like bandits. And so, you know, the market just hasn't taken into account, you know, quite how attractive these stocks are. And so DNO have quite sensibly looked at, you know, the sort of peach of the sector in a way, and said, right, well, I mean, it's cheaper to buy these things in the stock market than it is to actually go out and drill for it myself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you get a stage where, you know, and I think more will happen. I'm coming to another stock in a minute, which is chronically undervalued. But the point is that, you know, this, as I said before, this is shades of Ithaca. Now, Ithaca had performed well from the previous year because the oil price had bounced off the $27 level. And Faroe have performed quite well as well. The very fact that some, you know, decent quality big company thinks that it's appropriate to take 25 or 30% of the shares should indicate to investors and other people in the marketplace that these shares are undervalued in general as well as in specific terms.
Yeah. I mean, decent, you know, rally last 2 years, well, since 2016, it's, you know, it's at 50 pence a share, now it's at 123, that's fair, of course, so a nice sort of, it's been volatile, but it's more than doubled, so it's quite nice.
Yeah, I mean, it's been good, but I mean, it in my view, it should have been a lot better, and I tend to agree with that, and I think that, you know, a lot of people said that they weren't quite sure why Delek had sold out like this, because, you know, it wasn't quite the plan that they did with Ithaca, and but, you know, the point is that Delek bought their stake for 89p or 90p, that sort of level. You know, they were offered 125p a share for it. And in that process, they obviously felt that that was the, you know, the best they were going to get for the time being. There were a number of people who do feel, and still do feel, that you could create a significant North Sea and Norwegian Sea company by putting the Faroe and the Ithaca assets together, and you can't rule anything out, but it's not what Faroe want to do. As I said, Faroe are in their own right one of the best managements in the sector, with a very long term proven successful record of building a portfolio and having operational success. So you know, what's happened has happened. You can't disregard the markets, and as you said, the shares, you know, have doubled in 2 years. I just think that you know, the profitability of these companies now compared to what it was in 2015-16 is out of all recognition, and therefore, you know, these companies should be, quite a lot of them should be much higher valued.
Yeah, okay, marvellous. So if the current Faroe there, what else are you looking at, Malky?
Well, the second one, which is massively undervalued, which, you know, I tend to feel, and I think quite a lot of people agree, is that we're looking at Amerisur. Obviously, Amerisur is Colombia-based. These shares have been miserable performers at a time when they continue to deliver, you know, month after month. I mean, they do have, you know, a good program of telling people what's going on there. They have monthly updates and everything else. But the point is that they're well financed for something like 16 exploration wells in the next, what, in the sort of 18 months that we're just sort of 3 or 4 months into. But they made sort of something like three announcements last week. First of all was that they'd sold their first tanker load of crude, which was, you know, which is amazing. And that was 350,000 barrels of crude, which they got something over $21 million for, which is over $60 a barrel. So that's a massive tick in the box. March production continues to get better. It was down very slightly, you know, in one or two areas because they've got workovers going on in a couple of areas. But 6,500 barrels a day, 5,500 through the OBA pipeline. You know, so, you know, their money, you know, just do the sums, you know, 6,500 barrels a day net to them times $60, and they've got a lot of money coming in. As I said, they've got some very, very exciting exploration wells coming up. They're about to do a three-well back-to-back program on the N Sands anomaly on the Colombian acreage. I think that could be very, very exciting indeed. So I'd like to know how that goes. Mm-hmm. And that's about to drill. That's the rig is mobilizing there at the moment. They're about to drill Mirapara 1, which is on BUT-8. And, of course, the CPO-5 block, which is up further north where they had a big discovery. They've got Indigo-1 about to drill. So they've got a big exploration program. They've got a very strong balance sheet. They've got decent reserves. And, you know, I think that this company might pay a dividend if they're, you know, if they find that they're paying, if they're getting so much revenue in, and the shares are still absolutely stuck to the lows. You know, I don't understand it at all. There's nothing wrong there. You know, I mean, obviously, some people feel Colombia's a long way away, but, you know, we've got a lot of exploring going on in South America and some very smart UK companies doing it. So, you know, the share price here, if you've got them on the chart, AMER, has been a lot higher in the past. The management have got a fair bit of skin in the game. And particularly, I think, you know, it's nice to see the local CEO, John Wardle, who is one of the best operational men in the business. He put a lot of his own money behind it a little while ago. I just don't see what the problem is with this one. It should be massively higher. And if it isn't, someone will come and take it over. Because, you know, they're doing 6,500 barrels at the moment. Target is 7,000 in the short term, and then 12,000 and 20,000. And if you're producing even 12,000 barrels a day at $60+ a barrel, you're making a lot of money.
Yeah, well, the maths on 6,500 barrels times $60 for 300 days a year, that's $117 million, and that's and they might cap 162, so it's not far off.
Yeah,
that, you know? So. That's revenue almost close to their market cap anyway for 1 year.
I rest my case, and there's so much upside from, you know, all these potential mainly exploration but also appraisal wells. You know, as you said, the figures speak for themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. Marvellous stuff. Anything else, Malky?
Yeah, quickly, I want to go through Savannah Petroleum. Well, we've been away, have done two or three things, but most importantly, they've spudded the first well. They've got a three-well back-to-back program in Niger. You may remember that was meant to be drilled at the back end of last year, but it had to be held up because they're in the process of doing this huge acquisition of the 7 energy assets in Nigeria. So, first of all, the three back-to-back wells, the first well is spudded, and that's onshore, so we'll expect to see something before too long. And as I say, three in a row. In each case, they've probably got two separate targets to drill for. While they've been away, we've had the 7 Energy deal is closer to closing, which is very good. This is a transformational deal for the company. I know people are a little concerned that they didn't raise as much as they thought they were going to raise, but it's all set in place to significantly increase. I mean, it's out of all recognition the amount of hydrocarbons that this company will be producing soon, they are already producing a lot of hydrocarbons, and they've got a midstream business which in my view will be very profitable as well. So I'm very, very happy with Savannah. Mm-hmm.
I had Andrew on, and he's a guy who's I like his ambition, and like I said, he's very aligned with it. He holds a lot of stock himself, and he knows what he's doing. He's quite a sharp operator, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, he used to be a senior fund manager in the sector at GLG. He was a difficult man to take companies into because he's bright and doesn't suffer fools gladly, but he's an absolutely top oil guy. And I'm pretty convinced that Savannah is going to deliver the goods. Again, it's been a bit left behind because the people market, you know, obviously there's a big placing, but I'm very confident that he's going to deliver the goods.
Marvellous. Cool stuff. Anything else, Malky?
Yeah, I'm going to swiftly go through Echo Energy, which last week announced that it's mobilising at long last in Argentina. Everyone's been very excited about this, and they're starting off with the Fraction D, as they call it, where they're doing workovers there of existing wells. Three workovers there, which, if successful, will bring in gas to be piped in a pipeline, which wouldn't be enormously expensive. But the most important thing is that they've just got underway, which, you know, this is an exciting company in Argentina, as you know. And, of course, they've got an exploration program coming up in Fraction C. And the rig is, I understand it, ready to move on and will be on site in early May. So shareholders have been excited about, you know, the James Parsons stable. This is one of what I call the Holy Trinity, Sound, Echo and Coro. And at long last, we're going to get some really exciting news, not just on Fraction D or even Fraction C, but over the next 2 years, I think there's a lot to go for in Echo Energy.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Very briefly, I went into Chariot to see Larry Bottomley last week, because they are really drilling very, very exciting well. You've probably heard about this because they did a raise a little while ago. They're doing RD1, which is fully carried in that well, and it's offshore Morocco. But the most important thing is that this would be a transformation well in its own right. And I understand why people are, you know, nervous about the fact that we should be 20 days into the well by now, but my spies tell me that they're running behind time a bit. Nothing sinister, just a couple of technical delays. There are two things to know here. First of all, if RD1 comes in and, you know, it's a straight up out and out old-fashioned wildcat, that it will be transformational for Chariot. And the second thing is, if for any reason it doesn't come in, it is not the end of the world. This is not a one-trick pony, as they call it. They'll probably drill RD2 anyway. Then they've got some very interesting stuff in Namibia, which is the starting of Project S and then Project W. And then they're coming back to the Kenitra well back in Morocco. So if you've got people who are listening who are long-term holders of Chariot, or they've just taken some of the thing, the announcement will be very important. But if it doesn't come in, don't lose all hope, because there's more behind it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So, I do know it's quite popular. I've seen it mentioned a couple of times. Obviously, the action is happening there. I know a couple of people on Twitter there who've mentioned it to me. So and I'm not over it myself, so I don't know much of the story. But I know there's a lot of interest out there. So, but do you think?
The Chariot followers have been very keen on this one for some time, but they didn't drill anything at all last year. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they didn't. They stayed off the radar while they did all the background work, and they're getting carried by ENI and so on. So, you know, now we've got to the stage where they're actually drilling, and they'll probably drill three wells probably this year. So it's all the excitement is coming along together for Chariot after quite a long wait. And talking about long waits, just going to mention very briefly at the end, Providence Resources, with your old friend Tony O'Reilly and team, they actually farmed out Barry Rowe last week. I've been waiting for this for literally years. I had to check that it wasn't April Fool's Day when I saw that they'd done it.
Yeah.
But they've farmed it out to a Chinese consortium led by APEC, but with a couple of other better known COSL in there, which I know. The market didn't actually pick up on this one particularly, mainly because they thought that because of the slight complications, it wouldn't be completed until the third quarter. I said to begin with the end of the third quarter. I've been corrected now, it might be nearer the beginning of the third quarter, which is good. And they won't be able to drill it until next year. People thought they might drill it this year. Mm-hmm. But the new Irish regulations, Justin, say that you have to have 9 months of preliminaries nowadays before you'll get a chance to drill a well. So it's not entirely their fault. And so they will be drilling more wells on Barry Row next year. which should be, you know, should be exciting. As I say, we've waited a very long time for this.
Marvellous stuff. Marcus, fantastic run-up of some stocks here. Fero Petroleum, Ithaca Energy, Amaris Resources, Savannah Petroleum, Echo Energy, Chariot Oil and Gas, and Providence as well.
Lots to catch up on, Justin. Sorry about that.
No, it's good. It's information is good. Marky, thanks for that, and we'll catch up next week, fella.
Look forward to it.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is market analyst with Spreadex, is Connor Campbell. You all right, Connor?
Very good, thank you.
Now, Connor comes on the show and highlights or looks at the companies reporting, bigger companies are reporting news, trading updates, final results this week. So, Connor, who are we kicking off with?
We've got Card Factory. They're reporting their full-year figures on Tuesday. So there's been a lot of movement from Card Factory, I guess, in the last 15 months now. I think it actually ended up rising like 17.6% across 2017 as a whole. But from its, like, I think, like, end of September peak, it fell quite sharply. And I think so it was up 17.6% on the year, but down like 18% in the final quarter of the year, something like that.
But do you know what? I was looking at the chart here. Started up at £2.40 for the year of 2017, went up, double topped £3.40, so added a pound, and then it started coming back down, and almost like support levels, run about so just, about 2.90, then all of a sudden, when was that? What date was that? God, it literally gapped down massively on, it was, you probably didn't know why, but to 10th, to 20th, the 1st, so January, what is this? 1st, so 20, the 10th of January this year, it went from 2.80, it opened up, that, it finished off one day at 2.80, next day it opened up at 2.24, so it lost 60%, quarter of its value there. In a morning, that must be some kind of update they did, yeah.
Yeah. It was January post Christmas update, and you know, sales wise, things are pretty good at Card Factory. I think for the 11 months to the end of December, total sales were up 5.6%, with like-for-like store sales up 2.7%, which that like-for-like figure was a huge improvement on the 0.4%. It posted the same time the year previous. And the like-for-like sales figure jumps to 3% when you factor in its sort of online offerings as well, which for a high street retailer, very, very strong like-for-like sales figures. You know, you can't really argue with those. However, that growth was driven by lower margin products like gifts and dressings and things like that, with card sales, you know, its bread and butter actually flat on the year.
Yeah,
that sort of led to margin pressures for its full-year figures. I think it said that its full-year earnings would come in between $93 million and $95 million. At the midpoint, that would mark a 4.6% decline on what it posted the year previous. So that sort of really soured, you know, it was an effective profit warning that really soured what was, you know, if you just look to the sales figures, a very healthy healthier 11 months for Card Factory, and you know, sent it plunging towards, I think, you know, by the end of March it was trading at its, you know, all-time lows basically. You know, it's lurking around the £2 mic now, compared to, you know, like you were saying, £3.40 all-time highs last year. How I think, you know, our clients' perspective, they're buying quite heavily around those £2 mark, I think, just because of how sharply it fell in January. You know, it was a really aggressive sell-off for the stock. I think if it's going to be able to actually lift off those, I guess it ideally at the very least needs to come in at the top end of that £93 to £95 million earnings estimate. You know, if you could just get to like 95.5 as well, that might help. I think also any current trading update will be important. But obviously, this is the thing, like, its sales figures are good, but I can't see, you know, if card sales were flat across the year, well, card sales in general aren't gonna be going up anytime soon. Like, cards are like a dying thing, I guess. Yeah. You know, they're in a generation's time, I doubt there'd be a thing. Like, I wouldn't send a card to anyone, bar maybe like my mum, who would sort of expect a card. But anyone my age, you know, you just message them. So it is. I don't know what Card Factory can do to, you know, God, it's in its name. Like, I don't know what it does to pivot away from that very central issue, really. But short term, its sales figures are still strong. So if it can sort of suggest similar sales figures for the first quarter of its trading year, then perhaps it can lift away from its current lows.
Yeah, yeah. No, you're right. I mean, it is like newspapers, isn't it? It's like my parents take a newspaper every day, and they're like the odd card. They send the card at Christmas, and you know, me and my wife, we don't have a newspaper. We look at it online, and generally don't mind the odd card. The wife doesn't like cards pretty much. It's a waste of money. So yeah, I can't see there being a massive uptick in the popularity of cards in the next 5-10 years, you know? So, yeah, it's going to get to a certain level, I think, and start dwindling as well from there. But, yeah, it's certainly not a growing sector, is it? Unless they do something else, you know?
Yeah, no, definitely. I think, I guess, you know, people still buy sort of stupid gifts and stuff from shops like that, and, you know, birthday stuff as in balloons and stuff like that. I imagine that hasn't changed in popularity. So, if it does pivot towards that, then maybe it can sort of, you know, it's because he has success in selling those items. It just does mean that investors' expectations for earnings and profit and things like that will have to change, because like you said, they're lower margin products. And so if it does end up pivoting to something like that, which I imagine it will have to do in the next couple of years, I think just sort of the expectations for the company will have to shift a bit for it to avoid these kinds of like 20% single session drops.
Yeah, cool. Okay, Card Factory. Yeah, I wouldn't certainly be putting my money there. But obviously do your own research. So the next one is Tesco, is it?
Yeah, Tesco, their full year figures on Wednesday. It sort of, I think it ended up rising like something minimal, like 1.4% across 2017, which sort of papers over the cracks of what was a fairly tough year for Tesco, especially in market-wise at least, especially in the first seven and a half, 8 months of the year. I think at one point it was down to, it was below £1.70. Spent a good chunk of the summer below £1.70. But then I think mid-November onwards, it sort of quite a sharp rally that basically brought it back to where it was at the start of the year. Since 2018, again, it's sort of struggled for any kind of sense of direction, really. It's been trading between £2, £2.15. I think it fell briefly towards £1.90 in early February, you know, when the market as a whole was sort of losing its bottle. But beyond that, it has just been sort of bouncing between £2, £2.15. It's sort of towards the end of the bottom of that range at the moment. I think it's like £2.03 or something like that. Mm-hmm. In terms of its most recent figures, you know, January update for the 19 weeks to the 6th of January, I think UK and Ireland like-for-like sales were up 2.2%, which is pretty strong for the supermarket sector at the moment. But with group like-for-likes up just 0.6%, because I think the comparable sales in Asia were down 11% because it ceased bulk selling activities in Thailand. But if you focus on the UK, 2.2% is basically in line with what it's posted across its financial year so far, and is strong for a sector that has got a lot of, you know, pressures on it at the moment. However, I think investors sort of more focused on the Christmas period. And again, though, I think like-for-like sales in the UK were up 1.9%, which I think was its best Christmas sales growth since 2010. It was way off the 3.2% analysts had been expecting. I think that sort of gave a negative sheen to the update in mid-January, despite it being, you know, fairly solid. In terms of what it posts on Wednesday, you know, it's posted three consecutive quarters of strong like-for-like growth, you know, between 2.1% and 2.3%. However, obviously, the supermarket sector as a whole is dealing with sort of the twin pressures of rising food costs and an unwillingness to pass those food costs on to customers because of sort of disruptors like Aldi and Lidl always there to sort of swallow up any people put off by, you know, an increase in prices. So obviously that creates issues for margins and profit and things like that. So it's going to be interesting to see what kind of figures Tesco's actually post on Wednesday. I think last year it managed like a near 25% increase in its group operating profit before exceptional items. I think that was up to like 1.3 billion. Whether it can post a similar growth this year, I'm not quite sure. But from our clients' perspective, they've been buying it fairly strongly as it heads back towards £2. So obviously they're looking to keep it above that sort of bottom limit that it's been trading around in 2018. They're not looking for it to dip below that at the very least.
Yeah, do you know what? Like, yeah, it's tried to attack this area of like on the chart there, £2, £2.15 level quite a few times, and it's not been successful. More recently, it hasn't managed to close above two, sort of ten, and it's at £2 or £2.4 now. So unless they have stunning results, I can't see it getting above that. I think you're going to retest going back down to below sub £2 again. So we'll see though. So that range there, £2, £2.10. Let's see where it goes, north of that or south of that. Marvis, and what about WH Smith? How are they faring these days?
Yeah, they've got their half-year figures story on Thursday. You know, WHSmith is one of those stocks that was a surprise that it had a remarkably strong 2017. I think it was up 48% by the end of the year. It was basically closed the year at an all-time high of like just shy of £23.50. But since 2018 began, completely different story. Sort of has been on the back for the entire year. Hasn't been able to gain any positive momentum, and despite the situation of the company itself not really changing. Like its January update for the 20 weeks to the sort of mid-January, total sales were flat. Group for like-for-like sales were down 1% against what it said was a very successful period the year previous. You know, there was, as ever, the split between travel and high street. Travel total sales were up 7%, with like-for-likes up 3%. I think it opened, you know, two large new airport stores at Gatwick and Stansted. It's been expanding internationally. I think it's got something like 249 sort of locations internationally now, you know, the majority of them located in airports and coach stations and things like that. However, the high street, they saw total sales drop 5%, 4% decline in comparable sales. I think the main issue was, it said that whilst its gross margins had risen year on year for that 20-week period, they were still slightly less than anticipated because of lower sales of high margin spoof humour books. I think like the year previous, that just the same way that colouring books, you know, adult colouring books, maybe two and a half years ago, were sort of the key driver of keeping that those high street sales figures from really bottoming out. Adult, you know, spoof humor books were sort of the same thing last year, but obviously those kinds of books have like a 1 year cycle. Basically, I think WHSmith basically said that so many people that bought them the year previous, it's not the kind of thing you buy as a repeat present, really. It's sort of like a one and done stocking filler. So obviously without a new product to fill that void, perhaps its margins haven't been able to rise the same way it has been. But like I said, its situation is broadly the same as it was last year. It's just investors have decided to take a slightly different view of it. What will be interesting, you know, it has said that gross margins are up year on year. Mm-hmm. So I think given how sharply it's fallen, it could end up surprising investors just because the stock suggests the worst. But if it does end up posting some kind of increase on it, say the interim pre-tax profit, you know, it rose 4% last year to 83 million. That's a good rise, but it's not an unbeatable rise. If it can post a similar or like a 5% growth this year, then it could climb back above the £20 mark. And I think our clients have been buying since it fell below the £20 mark, and I think they're hoping it will bounce back above that following its half-year figures on Thursday.
Marvellous stuff. Yeah, it's a strong, you know, considering, like I said, I think we looked at this a while back, and the chart is strong considering they're in that sector where you think, you know.
Yeah.
It's almost like effectively the card factory sort of sector you compare it to. But I suppose there's a lot more they've got to offer there, haven't there? Like you said, there's books and it's a strategic locations as well. You know, you do find that sometimes they are the only option in some airports, you know. So you go there and buy stuff.
But for everything as well, isn't it? Because it's, you know, a last minute plane ride read, but, you know, a bottle of water or a sandwich or stuff like that. You know, it's like between WHSmith and Boots. If you don't want to go to that,
you get booze in there. You can get some booze in there, I think. You can get some books in there. You can get everything in there, from chewing gums to painkillers.
Yeah.
And, like I said, in the small airports, they are the only options. So I suppose they've got to...
I guess it's one of those companies that, despite ostensibly being a bookseller, has diversified enough away from that.
Yeah.
But, it's just a key shop in an airport because it covers everything.
Yeah, maybe that's what Card Factory need to do. And change, obviously have to change the card because that gives them away a bit. So maybe they just call themselves Factory. I don't know what they do. But there we go. Marvellous, Connor. Thanks for that, fella. And
thanks very much.
Speak next week.
Yeah, talk next week. Cheers.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are as follows. At five, 88 Energy, that's 88E. At four, Pantheon Resources, PANR. At three, Ascent Resources, AST. At two, UK Oil and Gas, UCOG. And number one, most followed company, is Coro Energy. Of course, was Saffron with a bit of a change, board restructuring, all that stuff. But it's CORO, and they've been admitted to first day dealings today as that entity, CORO. And now the top five most popular RNSs of the last 24 hours. They are at five, Stellar Diamonds. That's a director and PDMR shareholding. At four, Horizonte Minerals. posting of annual report and notice of AGM, that's HZM, of course. At 3, Sound Energy, SOU, completion of Italian divestment. At 2, Cora Gold Limited. This is Cora, not to be confused with Coro Energy. So C-O-R-A, this is based in Mali there. And that's Tekiliduku Reconnaissance Drilling completed. And hopefully Dr. Jonathan Forster, CEO, will be on the podcast very soon, Cora Gold. And number 1 was from Starcom, that's S-T-A-R, AGM statement. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos apreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hear the intriguing stories behind some of the world's best love songs in the FT's Life of a Song podcast. From soul to funk, to punk to jazz. Discover how classic songs like Smells Like Teen Spirit, Yesterday, and Stairway to Heaven were born. Search online or listen at ft.com/podcasts. Plus, don't miss the new Life of a Song book, featuring a compilation of 50 songs that have appeared in FT weekend columns. Pick up your copy from Amazon, your local bookshop, or give a gift to someone who'd enjoy this brilliant literary mixtape.